And thanks also. I understand there's been a delay in getting your questions across, and you still managed to confirm that you will go ahead today. So thanks for that.
Yeah, it's fine. I've been doing this long enough that I can talk about all of this in my sleep.
Absolutely.
I don't need
Absolutely.
much prep.
I
Although people
know.
always, don't always like to hear what I have to say, but
No, but we do. We do.
I have my opinions.
But we're very excited to have you here. So I'm gonna just give me a minute. I'm trying to write in. Okay. So we're just gonna kind of start with a bit of introduction. I set the tone. I do your own introduction, and we go ahead. But maybe also to know the members of the team on the call, and they will be supporting with, just helping us record and to
Sure.
guide us at the back end. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Okay, perfect. So I'm going to start right away. Right. Welcome, welcome, welcome everyone to this episode of the CAMA podcast series, a platform of the Corporate Alliance on Malaria in Africa, dedicated to driving dialogue and knowledge exchange on private sector engagement in the fight against malaria and other public health challenges. My name is Maurice Atoki. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the African Business Coalition for Health, and I lead the CAMA office, who serves as, Secretariat, ABCL7 as a Secretariat to CAMA. And at CAMA, our mission is to mobilize private sector capabilities, investments, and innovations to complement national and global malaria control efforts. We firmly believe that partnerships remain the cornerstone of achieving a malaria-free Africa. And by aligning the strengths of businesses, governments, civil society, and development partners around a shared vision of health impact and sustainable development, we can achieve that. As you know and agree with me, David, malaria continues to impose an extraordinary burden on Africa's social and economic development. According to the World Health Organization World Malaria Report in 2024, Africa alone accounts for 94% of global malaria cases and 95% of global malaria deaths. That's a lot. And despite decades of progress driven by scale-up of bed net, indoor residual spraying, and improved diagnostics, gains are increasingly fragile. Imagine insecticide and drug resistance, climate-driven shifts in vector habitats, and persistent financing gaps are complicating the road to complete elimination. Yet, this is also a defining moment. New tools are entering the pipeline. Next generation vaccines, advanced vector control technologies, digital surveillance platforms, and a growing movement towards African-led innovation and health system ownership. But the question is no longer simply whether elimination is possible, but how we build the systems, the strategies, and partnerships needed to get there, leveraging technology, leveraging new innovations at the scale, as well as sustaining the gains that we achieve. Now, today's episode is titled The Future of Malaria Elimination, subtitled Innovation, Scale, and Sustainability in Africa, discussing the innovations, the partnerships, and long-term strategies needed to scale effective interventions and build sustainable malaria elimination systems across the continent. And our conversation today will explore the innovations transforming malaria control, the structural barriers preventing proven interventions from reaching scale, and what a truly sustainable African-owned malaria elimination ecosystem must look like. And joining me today is a distinguished leader working at the intersection of malaria science, a very gentleman, health systems and policy, Mr. David McGuire. We're really honored to have you, David, with us. And to kick off, David, would you give us a sense of the current state of malaria elimination with your expertise across the African continent? Where we have made meaningful progress and where the most significant challenges currently are? David, over to you.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Moraes. It's a pleasure to be with you today and have an opportunity to share some of my thoughts. As I think you know, I've been working on malaria since the late 90s, and most of my career has really focused on malaria vector control, although I've been, involved peripherally in some of the other interventions, case management, health system strengthening, etc. I've worked for nonprofits, I've worked in academia and in the private sector. So I think that gives me a fairly good overview. Most of my career has really been focused on all of the things that you're talking about, which, really centers around the need for public-private partnerships, in order to achieve the objectives that malaria programs have. So the current state of malaria, I would say, is at the same time both promising and a bit daunting and scary. It is, as you said, a huge problem, particularly in Africa. I think the impact, we tend to focus on the health impact, which is dramatic. But as you said, it's more than a health issue. It is an issue of economic growth. It's an issue of education, of agriculture and tourism and just overall socioeconomic welfare of the African countries affected by malaria. And we've gone through a very interesting time over the past couple of years, where I feel that malaria programs in Africa have become too dependent on external inputs and resources, and that has created a certain sense of dependence and complacency. And so, with the sort of sudden and dramatic shift in funding, with various donors pulling back quite dramatically, it has really shaken things up, and caused a lot of challenges just in terms of having the resources to deal with things in the immediate, in the short term. So I think that there has been overdependence that is sort of creating a crisis of funding right now. On the other hand, I feel that there's a silver lining to that there seems to me to be a new awareness and realization among African heads of state, in part thanks to the work of ALMA and the End Malaria Councils. Unless countries take responsibility and have the political commitment to achieve malaria elimination, that it will not succeed. Now, do they have the resources and the tools today? No. But I think the starting point that has resulted from this crisis is a good one, in that there is this realization, and I think a growing commitment among African leaders to really take charge and no longer be dependent on any external funding. In the words of Joy Phumpi from ALMA, she said that donor funding needs to be complementary, not supplementary, which I think is key. So I think there are a lot of new and promising tools that can really help in the fight against malaria. I think that there needs to be more integration of malaria programs with other interventions for sort of efficiencies and economies of scale, and to build the proper health systems. I think there needs to be more of a holistic approach. I think what's been done over the past 5 years or so is to really focus on insecticide-treated nets primarily, and some case management. both critically important, but not sufficient. There needs to be a more comprehensive approach. There needs to be, even at the height of funding, from international sources, there was only about half the resource needed to achieve the goals of elimination. So it was never going to work. And we, there's not enough involvement at the community level, through the private sector. And I think, in addition to the political commitment, we need a more holistic approach, and we need one that's embedded in communities at the household level through increased awareness and not only leaders, political leaders taking responsibility, but also individuals, communities, and politicians throughout the country, not just at the national level. So I think there's a combination of huge challenges, but great opportunity and a lot to be hopeful about.
Absolutely, David. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, that really has set the tone for our understanding of the current state of malaria elimination across Africa. And I hear you clearly when you say that a lot still needs to be done, especially the recognition of the multi-stakeholder ownership and responsibility around this malaria control and even perhaps be ambitious to aspire towards elimination. To our audience, I'm going to now, for those of you who are trying to figure out who's David, I'm going to kind of just let you get a bit more acquainted with David through his profile. So, David Maguire is a strategic global health and development leader with deep expertise in multi-country program management and market access. It has a strong record of driving effective stakeholder engagement and successful product introductions across diverse markets. David has constantly supported the development of high-impact public-private partnerships that expand access to life-saving vector control tools while also advancing policy and regulatory advocacy to enable scalable and sustainable health interventions. Known for strong interpersonal effectiveness and cross-cultural communication skills, he has successfully fostered collaboration across multidisciplinary and multinational teams, ensuring alignment, execution, and measurable impact across complex global health initiatives. David, thank you once again for being with us. We're delighted to have you. And thank you for setting the tone as we begin to weigh the challenges that we're going to attempt to talk to in the course of this podcast. Now, I'm going to go straight to the questions, defining successful malaria elimination strategies. And we have about 10 minutes to do this. So, David, over the last 2 decades, and I know you've been quite pivotal and doing a lot of hard work around this malaria control and elimination, we've seen that malaria control efforts have delivered some measurable gains across the continent. But the pathways to elimination is becoming more complex as resistance patterns shift and operational realities evolve, some of them unprepared for, or maybe inadequately prepared for. From your perspective and a lot of experience you have, what will define successful malaria elimination today in Africa, and the strategies of it over the next 10 years? Over to you, David.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's not an easy question to answer, and I think one of the mistakes that we tend to make is to generalize across Africa, and every situation is different, in terms of the local commitment, resources, transmission settings, the political stability. There are quite a few conflicts. We have, unfortunately, humanitarian crises in various countries. We've got private sector that is very strong in some countries, not as much in others. So I think it varies from country to country, and even within a country, it varies from region to region. So I think we have to be a little bit more fine-tuned in how we look at solving the problem. And I think before we talk about elimination, we have to really make sure that we've dealt with control. And I think in many countries and in certainly in certain regions within countries, we haven't really gotten a grip on control, which is step one. I mean, elimination is a phased process, you can't really go for elimination until you've got things under control. And I think each phase of that process requires different tools, different resources, and that shifts over time. So, for example, in a very high transmission area, you really need to hit it hard with the most impactful interventions. You need to have very strong surveillance to identify cases and treat them promptly. You need to have a pipeline of drugs that can cope with the constant threat and risk of resistance. And then, I think something like 80% of the gains over the past 20 years in malaria control have come from vector control. So things like insecticide-treated bed nets. So, we now have really, really effective nets, these dual AI chlorpheniprine nets that are very highly impactful. And IRS is another tool that has been used. Now, when you talk to malaria control programs, I think they all agree that IRS is probably the one thing that can really knock down transmission quickly and effectively, but it's very difficult to deploy and there are operational challenges. With the bed nets, the new nets are very effective, but we're seeing issues with durability and consumer or user acceptance. In many places, you have, even when people are given nets for free, you have usage rates under 50% in many places. And the nets that are used don't tend to last a full 3 years, which is required from campaign to campaign. So that leaves people exposed. And in some cases, people get nets that aren't the right size, or they don't, they're not able to hang them properly because of the shape of their roof, or their sleeping arrangement is such that the type of net that they get doesn't work for them. So I think, we need to we need to understand how to do a better job with the nets, how we can look at it from less of a top-down approach and look at it more from a user-centric perspective. And really understand, what are the people's needs and how can you get them nets that work for them? And for those not reached through campaigns, how can you make these nets available through the private sector in the sizes, shapes, and colors that people really want rather than just the standard net? For IRS, the historical models for IRS are just too expensive and operationally challenging. So how can we, kind of rethink that and maybe approach things with a more community-based approach, where rather than mobilizing, teams of thousands of spray operators in, what seems almost like a military operation once a year, how can you build the capacity at the community level to have some people locally who can do the spraying and reduce the logistical challenges and the cost at the same time. The other thing is that there are tools out there that are very necessary for elimination, but not really sort of incorporated as much as they should be, like larviciding. I think that that's something that really hasn't gotten donor funding, and some malaria control programs have put their own funds forward to do that. Environmental management, which kind of goes along with larviciding, simple things like, if there's agricultural activity, rice production or something, trying to, make sure that there's effective vector control in that area or larviciding. Or where possible, making sure that those agricultural operations or mining or whatever might create conditions for increased transmission, standing water, et cetera, that those things are done at enough distance from, population areas.
Right.
So there's that. There's also, I think, really the challenge of, unpredictable weather patterns, which cause, severe flooding, for example, which could increase transmission, suddenly and displace people. So they're in an area where they don't, have protection that they need. There are new tools, things like spatial emanators that might work in humanitarian situations or with mobile populations or in urban areas where, bed nets and spraying are a bit more challenging. And as the demographics kind of go towards urbanization, I think we need to look at other tools and other delivery mechanisms and new routes to market for these tools.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's complex, but Dr. Morey, is one thing that is kind of striking to me is that we've got so many examples around the world of countries that have successfully eliminated malaria. And there is a bit of a blueprint, and it's going to vary, from country to country, and what works in Sri Lanka isn't necessarily going to work in Nigeria exactly. But I think there are fundamental principles in how you approach this, from political commitment to community education and mobilization to a holistic approach to changing the tools you use over time as the transmission setting evolves and you get closer to elimination, the types of tools you need to deploy change. In a control setting, you're really focused on things like nets and IRS, and as you get closer to elimination, you need more of a very effective surveillance system to quickly identify cases and come in and treat them with the right drugs, and to come in and do vector control in that area to contain it, rather than mass deployments of vector control across the country. So I think there is a blueprint. There's a lot we can learn from. And I know this is maybe another topic we'll get into, but how can we learn from those experiences, and how can we use technology? How can we use AI to help us analyze what's worked elsewhere, how that might be different in a given African setting, and what adaptations are needed, and maybe helping to predict, what's the time frame, the budget? Because I think in a lot of cases, donors and governments keep throwing money at the problem, and they're not seeing the progress that they want because there's not there's not an end game. There's not a really convincing plan in place that says, this is what we need to do. This is how long it's going to take. This is how it's going to evolve over time. And this is how much it's going to cost. And I think if we can do that, we'll have a more realistic and successful approach to malaria elimination in Africa.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I did hear you when you talked to the country specificity in terms of the strategies that will definitely work. And looking at looking between control and elimination also is critical to consider. Talking about the malaria net, and I can talk from this part of the world. As simple as it seems, as accessible as it seems, and as available as it seems, it's almost unbelievable sometimes when you have to deal with the acceptance and the actual the practical use of it. And so I'm really glad that you're talking to those practical scenarios that we face. Why really aren't people, even though we still see malaria killing babies and killing adults, why won't people just really get used to using things as basic as mosquito nets? So even looking at the architectural preference from urban setting to rural settings, to where people live, the convenience, and so on and so forth, are really, really practical issues that need to be considered. And as much as possible, adopting a user-friendly approach to control, other than a top bottom, kind of things, that's
Yeah.
taken across business tables and negotiations, that really isn't of much priority to the user. So really, thanks a lot for sharing that. And I like the fact that you ended talking to our next question on technology. So this innovations, we have another 10 minutes. And so if we consider the malaria landscape, we see that it's been reshaped by advances in vector control, in data intelligence and surveillance systems, as well as product innovation. What emerging technologies and interventions do you consider have the greatest potential to transform malaria elimination efforts and, of course, also control across the continent of Africa? Over to you, David.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll surprise you by saying that I think the most important innovation is not necessarily with the products, but how we deliver them. We simply do not have in the current model that's being used and has been adopted over the many years that this has gone on. It's very dependent on donor funding, distribution through the public sector, which puts an increased burden on an already overtaxed public sector, clinics, hospitals, health workers, etc. So I think we need innovation and we need to turn the supply chain upside down and have a more bottom-up approach. And I think that the private sector can help with that. I think that there's this mentality that these malaria tools are a public good and they have to be given out for free for to everyone, but we know that people, even in low-income communities, spend quite a bit of money on insect control already, and they're using maybe products that don't work as well. We also know that the private sector can, there are examples where the private sector can help government programs and donor-funded programs, publicly funded programs, more efficiently deliver pharmaceuticals and vector control tools, that are subsidized but delivered through existing private sector channels. There are ways to do that. So I think that's a really important area of innovation is the delivery mechanisms and how we do it. And I also think that we need to again have a more user-centered approach to this. I think some people in the malaria world don't like to hear this. We're all trying to eliminate malaria, but in general, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my experience is that people don't necessarily adopt vector control because they're necessarily trying to prevent malaria. They just don't want to get bitten by mosquitoes. They want to sleep. They want to, and malaria is just kind of something that they live with, like the flu or the common cold, and it's just part of life. Now, I think there are groups like pregnant women and young children where there is more of an emphasis on protecting them against, because they're the most at-risk populations. But for the general population, they're interested in insect control, which is fine. But we just need to understand what drives them to use these products or adopt these products. And how do we build on that in a way that will help us achieve malaria elimination, but meet people where they're at and give them products that are adapted to their preferences, lifestyles, etc. So that's one thing. Now, in terms of specific products, we have really good IRS, but the way it's delivered, and the presentation of it is such that it requires, a great sort of logistical effort and a high cost. Can we develop more user-friendly, community-based products? Can we have, sort of single-use IRS that people can buy and use in their own homes? We also need to, with all these tools, we need to keep in mind that resistance is inevitable. So there needs to be a constant pipeline of drugs and vector control tools. And there are product development partnerships like IVCC and MMV that are working on that. That is critical. I think there's a new tool that there's been a lot of buzz about lately, the spatial emanators, the Guardian from SC Johnson, for example, that you hang in the room, very user-friendly. A lot of people don't like to use nets because they're difficult to hang, they're maybe hot. And this you just hang on the wall, and it protects people in that room for a year. That is really an interesting technology, but it uses an insecticide again that will eventually be subject to resistance. So there needs to be a pipeline of new volatile pyrethroids that can be applied to these spatial laminators. Then you've got the really kind of high-tech fancy things. You've got things like genetically modified mosquitoes. You've got, vaccines, things like that. And, again, at the risk of being controversial, I think those are really, kind of attractive in many ways, but have huge challenges. And I think that, we're a long way from having a vaccine that is, ideal in terms of preventing transmission and working with a larger demographic group, not just young children, more affordable. And maybe we never get there, Dr. Morris. I mean, I used to work in HIV, and every year you would go to the HIV conferences and they would say, we're 5 years away from a vaccine. We're 5 years. And that went on for like 15 years. And then finally they just gave up, and they found therapeutics that were able to manage effectively HIV/AIDS. So is it the right investment in as you invest in a very difficult, challenging, vaccine that may never materialize at the level we need it? Would that money be better spent on things that are proven that we know work, like vector control and drugs, medicines, seasonal malaria, chemo prevention, etc.? In terms of the genetically modified mosquitoes, really interesting. But what I've sensed, I was at a meeting in Dakar in December where the latest research was presented on the genetically modified mosquitoes. And while it looks very promising, it seems to me that there's a high degree of skepticism or discomfort among African malaria control programs because it's a little bit sci-fi. People are worried, is this really going to work? I think the political challenges with deploying that are going to be huge, although, in the lab it looks quite promising. So I'm a little bit old school. I think, for the time being, we can really focus on the tools that work. And if we have the political commitment, we continue to manage resistance with both vector control and medicines. We take a more holistic approach that uses the full range of tools, not just one or two. And we understand that the situation is going to be different in every country, and we need to approach it differently in every country. I think we'll get there. So yeah, those are some thoughts on new technologies. There are some unbelievably good African research institutes that are looking at this, and trying to develop new tools, working with industry, working with the product development partnerships. And who knows, maybe we'll find some other things. Hopefully we will. But right now, we do have effective tools, and we just need to innovate more in terms of resistance management, maybe introducing more larvaciding, more spatial laminators in the right environments, and having more of a user-centered approach to both product design and delivery mechanisms and channels.
Thank you so much, David. It's good to hear that some of these emerging technologies and transformative innovations will not come from new products, but the how on our existing products need to be managed more optimally. I mean, hearing that just really sounds quite fresh and practical to the situation at hand. So thank you.
And
Thank you
don't
so
get me
much.
wrong, Dr. Moyes. I am totally for, these new technologies. I just think we need to be realistic in terms
Absolutely.
of the cost and time frame and doing sort of a cost benefit analysis of each of them. I think a lot of times things sound really sexy, the new bright shiny thing, but they may not make sense yet.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep striving for the vaccines and the, looking at the genetically modified mosquitoes and things that we haven't even thought of yet that may emerge. But we do have tools and approaches that have been used effectively to eliminate malaria in countries as big as China. Egypt, Sri Lanka, the list goes on. It's been done before. And I would say in all of those cases, one interesting common denominator is that to a large extent, none of those programs really relied on external funding. There was some external funding, but it was political commitment, community mobilization, just an understanding that this is a years-long process. And that it's going to involve phases and a combination of multiple tools and interventions. And you need that political commitment. I think one other important element here is that we've looked at malaria elimination as a health issue. And as I said earlier, we need to make sure that ministers of health and malaria programs are very limited in terms of their influence and their control of finances. So, the case really needs to be made at a much higher level and in a more integrated fashion. This, the problem of malaria is a national security threat. It's something that threatens the economic and social welfare of a country. So we need to get ministers of finance, ministers of education, ministers of agriculture, ministers of mines and petroleum and tourism. It affects all of those areas. Defense, having a healthy military. It's so much bigger than health. Health is obviously the primary driver and the main focus, but it's much bigger. And until we mobilize political commitment across the board and not just have it be limited to health, we're not going to have the overall national commitment and the resources necessary to achieve elimination.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more with you, David. Thank you so much for sharing even deeper insights around emerging technologies and transformative innovations. It's really important that we think in the direction that you just commented, so that we don't get lost, in the new shining objects. just across the room. So thanks a lot for bringing that into into your perspectives. I'm going to go to the third question on barriers to scaling innovation. And so I mean, this really piggyback on your last comments and answers to the previous question on innovation, what you consider innovation across the supply chain mostly, and the how that malaria tools and malaria interventions are being disseminated for both control and elimination. Across global health, that we must agree that many promising malaria solutions demonstrate success, but at pilot settings, but they still struggle to achieve meaningful scale. Now, in your experience, David, what are the biggest barriers to scaling some of these innovations, and what practical conditions are required to move from proof of concept to widespread impact? Over to you, David.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, there are all sorts of examples of, malaria elimination on a small island or that kind of thing. Or in countries that are smaller, with strong political commitment and, pretty high levels of funding. And when you take that and try to translate it somewhere else, it doesn't necessarily work. I think part of it is, again, you can prove a tool works in a community setting or through an RCT or something like that, and we've done that over the years. But again, we don't think enough about the user in the way we design the product. So when you've got a product that works really well in a controlled environment, whether it's in a laboratory or in a field trial, using, hut trials for vector control and that kind of thing, and you try to scale it up without having looked at, user issues and distribution issues and cost issues. Yes, the thing works, but do people really want it? And is it affordable? And is there a viable distribution plan to get it to the people who need it? And is there enough funding to educate the people and promote it in a way that makes sense to them and resonates with them, not just this is a really good thing, you should use it, trust us. And yes, I know it's uncomfortable or it doesn't look good or it's inconvenient to access, but trust us, it's going to be great. I think we've been very, sort of, we need to approach this like commercial marketers approach product development and deployment. You really need to look at, what is the need and how do you develop something that works for someone in real life, not just in the laboratory? How do you position it with the people? How do you distribute it? What is the cost of that product? Whether it's a monetary cost or a cost in time, travel, lost work to go get whatever they need at the clinic. So I think there needs to be a more comprehensive look at that as we, go from pilot proof of concept to scaling up. And again, I can't emphasize enough the need to look at private sector as an essential channel for the distribution and promotion of products. There are plenty of people out there who are willing to pay for things that meet their needs, even in low-income populations. And we just need to internalize and embrace the idea that even though we wish we could give everything away for free to everyone, we don't have the resources to do that, and that's not sustainable. So we need to really target the most vulnerable, indigent, populations that really can't do it without government support, and having that safety net and using the limited resources from the public sector or through charitable donations or whatever to really, make sure those people are taken care of, and then have a segmented approach where, those who maybe can't afford a full, commercial price, we can find ways to subsidize things, but deliver them through a sustainable, very effective private sector channel. And then for a large chunk of the population, again, if you have solutions to real problems, people are willing to pay. I often use the example of, early in my career, I lived in Mali, which is, one of the lowest income countries in the world. Very challenging environment in many ways. And there was a culture of bed net use there. When a baby was born, at the baptism, one of the presents that they would get from a relative was a bed net. When a couple got married, they would get a bed net. All these things. So there was a real culture. And before there was any donor funding, you had over 70% of the Malian population, many of whom were very poor, buying bed nets for anywhere from 5 to 12 US dollars. There was a culture of net use, and people not only, when people buy something, they're more likely to use it and they're more likely to take good care of it. So the problem was the nets were not treated, and that was the challenge, introducing treated nets. And so we tried to do that for a while, and it was successful. And then a decision was made to just let's get universal coverage and give everything out for free, which sounds good. I mean, that's a noble thing to do. The problem is now that the funding has gone away, you've destroyed the private sector sustainable local distribution and promotion, and everyone's wondering, what do we do now? Another thing is, you hear a lot now about local manufacturing and how that is important. Well, I'll give you an example. In let's say 2003, 2004, there were five insecticide treated net man, or no, not insecticide treated nets, five net manufacturers in Tanzania alone. There were three net manufacturers in Nigeria. There was one in Kenya. There were net manufacturers throughout Africa. And when the donor community made the decision to go for universal coverage, they basically put all of those net manufacturers out of business, except for one in Tanzania. And now everyone's saying we need local manufacturing when we had it, but the strategy we employed was too dependent on donor funding. It went for the lowest possible cost, which is understandable to maximize coverage. And, in terms of, value, quality, et cetera, you can't beat textile manufacturing from Asia. And so that wiped out the African manufacturing. And now people are saying, why don't we have African manufacturing? Well, we had it and we could have supported that, but we went in a different direction. So, yeah, I think I think we need to, figure out what are we trying to do here? Are we trying to have the maximum public health impact? Are we trying to create jobs? Are we trying to stand up these projects that involve national pride and self sufficiency? I mean, all of those things are worthwhile endeavors, but if you try to do it all and at the same time, you end up, I think, watering down the public health impact you have. So I think we really need to kind of say, okay, what is our main goal here? If it's malaria elimination, that requires a certain approach. It needs to be more comprehensive, more locally driven, more sustainable, meaning less donor dependent and more user driven. Those are the, I think, the key elements of a successful strategy.
Thank you so much, David, for that. And so, audience, you've heard David on barriers to scaling innovation, very aptly put. I'm just going to go right into the fourth question on building sustainable malaria elimination ecosystems. Another 10 minutes. And so, to you, David, we agree that sustaining malaria progress requires more than external funding. It depends on resilient systems, market readiness, and you've said that in many words today. And of course, long-term national ownership. What does a truly sustainable malaria elimination ecosystem look like? I mean, when we're talking ecosystem, we're talking beyond individual efforts and capacities. What does that look like for African countries, and what shifts really are needed to build this? Over to you, David.
Yeah, well, again, I think it's really important that we look at what has worked in the past elsewhere and learn from that. There are so many examples. I am based in Washington, D.C., and many people don't realize this, but up until, I don't know, maybe 100 years ago, malaria was a problem here. Washington, D.C. is built on, what used to be kind of swampland. Very conducive to malaria. One of the biggest challenges in the US during sort of the time of the Civil War and the Revolutionary War, was malaria, which and yellow fever, which probably killed more people than the actual fighting. So it has been done. It's been done in places like China and Egypt and many other countries. So let's look at what has worked and what are the elements. And again, it is in my view, it's prioritizing control before you attack elimination. It's going to be a phased approach. Having that political commitment that goes beyond health to having it be a national issue that affects many sectors. I think, having a very strong and resilient surveillance system in place that can identify where the problems are, using technology, using AI to help decision makers efficiently deploy the tools in the way that's going to have the biggest impact using the resources that they have. I think, that kind of technology-enabled decision making is something we need to do. Learn from the past and adapt to the local situation. Looking at increased domestic resources. Now, that in many countries, governments don't have, a lot of, there's not a lot of money sitting around. There are so many priorities. So there is some national investment that needs to be made, but it can also come from the private sector, individual households, foundations, etc., complemented by donor funding. Again, complementary, not supplementary. I think we need to have context-specific strategies and not look at this as how do we eliminate malaria in Africa? We need to drill down and say, okay, what's going to work in DRC or Nigeria, the two most affected countries, the highest burden countries, and how does that differ from, say, Bonny Island in Nigeria to Sokoto or Kebbi, some very, very different settings, very different cultures, very different transmission settings. So really, kind of context-specific approaches. Again, user-centered design in not only the products, but how they're delivered and promoted. Phased adaptive strategies in each country that recognize that as things evolve and as you get closer to elimination, you need to kind of change the emphasis of what you're deploying in terms of tools. And then again, as you're doing all of this, based on what's worked elsewhere, adapting it to the local situation, using the tools we know work and kind of keeping them as effective as possible by dealing with resistance, whether it's the medicines or the vector control, and then continuing to work on innovation. What are some of the other things that could work? Is it the vaccine? Is it genetically modified mosquitoes? Or is there something we haven't thought of yet? So yeah, I think those are all fundamental to a kind of scalable, sustainable malaria elimination effort,
Ecosystem.
but an ecosystem. But again, I mean, it's been done before, and so that gives us hope. There is kind of a blueprint that can be adapted. We just need to make sure that the tools that are available are used properly, that they're delivered through the right channels, that we focus more on locally adapted approaches and sustainable approaches that are less donor dependent. And we need to understand that every country is going to be different, and even within countries, there's a lot of variability. But I think too, and this is really relevant to a group like CAMA, I feel like as I've tried to build effective public-private partnerships over the years, that everyone talks about the private sector as a partner, but they really aren't. They're more of a potential source of complementary funding that, country programs or donors approach or foundations saying, this is important to your business, you should invest in it. And, can you help fund this, that, and the other thing? Well, I mean, lots of big companies, whether they're mining companies, oil companies, they have CSR, they have foundations. And that's all good. There's a lot of incredible work that's done to fund clinics and deployment of bed nets and other things. But I think that if the private sector is going to be effectively engaged, they need to be engaged from the start. They need to be looked at not only as a source of funding, but as an implementation partner and part of the national economic welfare of a country. How does malaria impact that business, which impacts the GDP of a country? It affects jobs. It affects so many things. And not just sort of we'll figure it out and then we'll let the private sector know when we're ready, or the private sector being kind of a partner in that we want you to provide the least expensive products possible, even if it means you kind of breaking even or losing money, but it's for a good cause, so please do it. No, I mean, companies need to remain viable. I think one of the challenges, Dr. Moyes, is that a lot of the donors, they're under a lot of funding pressure. The available funding has been cut, so they're trying to do as much as they can with limited funding. So you've got a lot of private companies that are really strong in R&D, whether it's on the medicine side, the big pharma companies, or the vector control side, net manufacturers, spatial emanators, IRS, etc. And they, for public procurements, are being squeezed so much to the point where it's hard for them to remain viable. And so once they introduce their products, everything shifts to generic, which are more affordable. But if you go in that direction for drugs and vector control, at a certain point, these really robust R&D companies are going to get out of the game. And yes, you'll have a cheap product for a given amount of time, but once resistance hits, you're not going to have that pipeline of products coming through because they will have decided that it's no longer financially viable. So I think, the private sector is so important, and it's however, how do people get their food? How do they get their clothing? Private sector. And we're not tapping into that enough. We're creating a parallel distribution channel, a subsidized, kind of development pipeline that, isn't really sustainable, unless we change course and really involve the private sector from the
From the
get-go as
start.
a full partner and not just a source of product or complementary funding.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more, David. And really, I mean, private sector, the thing with them is sustaining any kind of relationship with private sector is getting them involved at as early as possible at the very start. And better not take for granted, their lack of technical understanding of the nuances, based on the fact that a lot of health and medical terminologies will be in will be naturally embedded in this kind of intervention, if it ever gets to private sector involvement. But again, if we, you're like you're right, if we consider it private sector as a very strategic critical stakeholder, then the earlier we start engaging in a very optimal way, in a way that perhaps we're not even used to yet, but in a way that is as creative as possible to get the private sector more invested in building the solutions of control and elimination of malaria, the better
And
for the
Dr.
whole
Moyes, just
movement.
one quick note that I think is another reason for optimism and hope is that, the malaria world has kind of been shaken, as other sectors have been, with funding cuts and trying to reorient and figure out how to do more with less. But I think if we look back, there are examples, for example, in HIV/AIDS and family planning, which used to be 100% donor funded and totally reliant on donor funding those programs. And when the funding shifted, we can look back to the early 2000s when the Global Fund and the US government and the Brits and others started to really invest in malaria. Funding shifted a bit from family planning, for example, and to a certain extent, HIV. And to a large extent, family planning is now, not very dependent at all on donor funding, and products are getting out there on a fully sustainable basis. They're affordable, they're accessible. So I think we can look at other sectors, other areas where this sort of disruption in the funding hasn't caused things, hasn't had a cataclysmic sort of outcome. It's
Mm-hmm.
been figured out, and a large part of that solution has been private sector. And so I
Absolutely.
think that's something that can really give us some hope, and we need to look at that more. How have malaria control programs effectively eliminated in other countries? And what are examples in other sectors where private sector solutions have played a major role in solving this funding gap that we're now looking at in malaria?
Thank you, David. That's it on building sustainable malaria elimination ecosystems. So I'm going to go to the last question now before your closing reflections. And this is question number five on African-led innovation, again, building on some of the very great and remarkable comments that you've shared here today, and local health leadership. So given that there's growing momentum around African-led innovation, you could say, and locally driven health leadership across the continent, how do you consider African institutions, entrepreneurs, and policymakers playing a stronger role in shaping malaria solutions that are context specific, that are scalable, and ultimately more effective than externally designed models? Over to you, David.
Yeah, no, I look, there's no lack of talent or capability in Africa. There are so many of the best researchers in malaria are African, based in Africa. And I think again, the silver lining of this shift from, I think, a largely donor-driven approach to a more locally led approach has really put those researchers and innovators in a better position to take on a leadership role. And I think, to their credit, a lot of the donors are embracing that. And I see a lot of good signs in terms of, whenever donors are involved, putting the African research institutions and individuals involved in the forefront, and talk, looking to them for to be the voice, rather than the voice coming from Geneva or Washington or Seattle or whatever. So I think a lot of progress has been made. There's a lot of talent, and I think, again, if once you get that political commitment at the country level, I think a lot of that will come from local leadership really putting their institutions in the forefront. There are so many, too many to kind of list, but you've got great research institutions in Cote d'Ivoire and Benin and Cameroon and Kenya and Ghana, Nigeria, Ethiopia. They're all very capable, and they just need to be given the opportunity and the resources to do their work and be at the forefront. So I think that's starting to happen, and we just need to embrace that and support that more and more.
Absolutely, David. Thank you so much for that very critical address of the question on African-led innovation and local health leadership. One of the most paramount aspects of all of this conversation, local ownership is critical. And now we're going to go into closing reflections. And I've had to go off camera to just sustain my bandwidth. I hope you don't mind. So
No.
before we wrap up, let's just distill this very rich conversation into few key takeaways. So David, what will be the most significant and important insight you would want our listeners, from program leaders and business executives, so private sector, public sector, policymakers, and community advocates to carry forward from today's discussion about the path to malaria control and elimination on the African continent? Over to you, David.
Yeah, thank you. Well, like we said in the beginning, there's a lot of fear and concern and anxiety right now, given the state of funding, which is all justified. But there's also reason for hope. there's reason for optimism in terms of, like we said, many countries have successfully eliminated malaria, and many of them have managed to do that without a lot of external resource. What can we learn from that, and how are those experiences adaptable to the African context? So I think there's a lot of hope in that. There's a lot of hope in looking at other sectors, the successes that have been achieved in areas like family planning, HIV/AIDS, WASH, through public-private partnerships, creating sustainable, locally led solutions that are not donor dependent, but do still benefit from donor support in a complementary way. So yeah, I mean, I think. When you look at malaria, resistance is always going to be a problem, whether you're talking about medicines or vaccines or vector control. And so there needs to be continued investment in having a pipeline of products that will deal with resistance over time. That's never going to go away. I think, for me, the key elements of a successful program start with high-level political commitment and stable funding. I think that, one of the areas that is very kind of vulnerable and was really supported to a large degree by donors and, the US government in particular. Was monitoring and evaluation and strong surveillance systems to track both insecticide resistance, resistance to drugs, case detection, and to enable proper deployment of tools and rapid response. You need integrated vector control that's adapted to the local situation. You can't eliminate malaria with just bed nets. Bed nets are a control tool. They're not really an elimination tool. They're very important. They've had more of an impact than anything else. But you also need to find a way to use other effective tools like IRS, larvaciding, etc. And you need to look at environmental management too, eliminating breeding sites. Case management is critical. And I think as you get closer to elimination, surveillance and case management based on successes elsewhere, that really ends up being the major focus, and vector control is used when and as needed in a focal way rather than mass deployment. When you're in a control setting, vector control is it's going to have more of an impact than anything else. Community engagement and user-centered design of both products and delivery mechanisms. What is going to work in people's real everyday lives? What are the issues that they have? What's going to motivate them? And how do you make things affordable and accessible through both public and private sector channels? Multi-sectoral engagement, again, public-private partnerships, and looking at malaria not only as a health challenge, but as something that is critical to the socioeconomic welfare of all countries in sub-Saharan Africa. It affects military readiness, to education, to agricultural output, to productivity in the mining sector and the oil and gas. It affects tourism. It affects so many things. So we need to look beyond just health to get the political support and resources necessary. So I would say that those are the main areas that I think we need to consider. But
Right.
lots of challenge, but again, lots of hope and opportunity. Lots of examples of success, and so I'm excited right now. I think there's a lot of new energy that I've sensed throughout Africa, throughout African malaria elimination programs, kind of an excitement about being in a position to take more of a leadership role and not necessarily just do what is possible, with the donor funding provided, but to really influence not only what donors invest in, but also to guide this new frontier of countries taking responsibility and mobilizing all of the resources in the public and private sectors to achieve malaria elimination. So I'm very optimistic. I hear a lot of pessimists out there. I'm more of a glass half full type person, but I'm excited. I think we can do this, but we need to, look at things a little bit differently and learn from the past, adapt to
Yeah.
local realities, and I think we can be successful.
Absolutely, David. I'm going to join you in that optimism. We must be optimistic to do things differently. And so, finally, if you could send one message to the global health community about what Africa needs most right now to accelerate malaria elimination, not more of the same, but something genuinely different, what will that message be? Over to you, David.
Yeah, well, it's tough to wrap that into one message, but what I would say is, the malaria community needs to really continue to focus on innovating the technologies that we have to deal with resistance. We need to keep that pipeline of products going for vector control and medicines. We need to innovate around distribution, and we need to realize that what we have done in the past is not going to get us where we need to go. We're trying to get to the moon in a race car, and we need rockets. We need better delivery systems. We need to understand that the public sector is overburdened and needs to be focused on the most vulnerable, and that there are ways to reach people through the private sector, through things that have worked in other areas. And I just think that there's this sense in the donor community, like, how do we deal with this, and how do we solve the problem, rather than, wait a second, it's not our problem to solve, it's the problem of each country that's affected by malaria, and how can we support them and empower them to complement what they're going to do on their own, rather than trying to do it for them and feel like it's on us. We need to, I think, in the international community, step back and just change the whole perspective about how we approach this, be a resource rather than a substitute. So I would say those are the main things. Let's continue to
Right.
innovate in the products we deliver and how they're delivered. Let's support countries in taking ownership and mobilizing multi-sectoral partnerships that are going to help us, achieve malaria elimination. And let's do a better job of using AI and
Yes.
technology to learn what has worked in the past and how that can be adapted to our current situation. What are the gaps? What is it going to take? Quantifying that and having a clear plan that everyone can get behind, rather than just continuing to throw money at something and having, kind of hit a plateau and not really making progress. So those would be my main, kind of points that I would raise with the malaria community.
Thank you so much, David, and really well said, genuinely and really passionately. We thank you sincerely for such a compelling and deeply informed conversation. Truly, you have helped us to see malaria elimination challenge with greater clarity, not just as a scientific or technical problem, but as a systems challenge that demands innovation, political will, African ownership, sustained collective actions across every sector, particularly reimagining how to engage private sector. At CAMA, we believe that the path to a malaria-free Africa runs through exactly this kind of conversations. Ones that bridge data and lived reality, that connect innovation with implementation, and that center African voices and solutions at the heart of the response. To our highly esteemed listeners and audience, we want to thank you for joining us for today's episode of the Kama Podcast series. We hope today's discussion has genuinely both informed and inspired you. I've been inspired. I want to encourage you to stay connected with us through our platforms as we continue to spotlight the voices, the partnerships, and innovations shaping Africa's malaria elimination journey. I am Dr. Maurice Atoki, the Chief Executive Officer of the African Business Coalition for Health, typically known as ABC Health, and KEMA Office Lead. And I look forward to welcoming you again for our next episode. David, have a great day ahead. Bye
Thank you
for
very
now.
much for the opportunity. Thank you. And thank you for all you do.
Thank you, too.